The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to the Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us. Please follow us at danproftshow.com on social media at danproftshow. And we begin this program by tackling the Bubba Wallace case as the FBI, after investigating the noose found in his garage at his garage stall at Talladega, that it was a noose that was there, or a garage pole that was fashioned as a noose, sort of semantics. I don't want to get into the semantics. The FBI is saying it was fashioned into a noose, that Bubba Wallace confirms that. So let's start from that premise. But saying that noose had been in that garage stall since at least October of 2019, well predating the race over the weekend and any knowledge that Bubba Wallace, the one black NASCAR driver, would be assigned that stall. So there is no hate crime. Which is why the reaction is so curious, but I guess part of this is because so many people are immediately invested in wanting to believe the worst about America, to believe in institutional racism, to believe that black Americans of profile are being targeted, just as black Americans and other Americans of no profile are being targeted by white racists, are victims of white privilege. And so the reaction from Bubba Wallace, you could pick and choose, because he essentially reiterated his position on the Today Show this morning that he did, that he offered on Don Lemon's show on CNN last night.
I'm pissed. I'm mad because people are trying to test my character and the person that I am and my integrity, and they're not stealing that away from me, but they're just trying to test that. And as a person, Don, that doesn't need the fame, doesn't need the hype, doesn't need the media, I could care less. I could give two craps about that. But to sit there and read, and that's my problem. I'm reading too much into it and investing too much time into it. I am.
I know.
I'm trying hard not to. And after tonight, I'll probably turn my phone off. Unfortunately, until about 7:30 in the morning, where the interviews start back up again and we get to it all over. But Don, to hear my side of the story,
it's a little interesting. He doesn't care at all about the mob on Twitter questioning his integrity, but he's very upset about it. Well, which is it? He doesn't need the media, but he's volunteering to do all of these interviews where he's offering sort of a less pointed iteration of the victimhood pablum that the left promulgates. I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but that's the case. What you have at this interview is two unbelievable American success stories. I don't particularly care for Don Lemon, but I don't deny that he's a success story, black American. And obviously, Bubba Wallace is a success story. He's a professional athlete. And they're trading cant about victimhood. Their stories are stories that could happen in very few places other than America. And so Bubba Wallace's message to the kids out there?
The backlash will always be there. It doesn't matter if we provide 100% facts and evidence, photo evidence. People are going to Photoshop it to make me look like the bad person at the end of the day. I will always have haters. I will always have the motivators to go out there and to try to dethrone me from the pedestal that I'm on. For all the kids that are watching and want to be in sports, just know that you will automatically become or be put on a pedestal, whether you like it or not. That's what happens when you have a voice and you have a platform. People are going to try to take that away from you with all their power. They will lose sleep over making sure you don't succeed. So you have to be strong. Always keep your head on a swivel and always watch your back, but always stand up for what's right.
Yeah. I don't buy that public service announcement. Sorry. I mean, poor Bubba Wallace. He has fame and fortune and gets to do what he loves to do for a living. It's a really sad story. Oh, there are people that don't like you? Oh, in life, some people cheer and some people boo? Welcome to the human condition, Bubba Wallace. For more on this, pleased to be joined again by our friend, also a professional athlete, a Super Bowl champion, former NFL player, founder of the national mentoring program Second Chance for Youth, and author of Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism, as well as one of the best books titles ever, Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. He is Burgess Owens. Burgess, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Dan, I felt like giving you a standing ovation, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
You nailed it. I don't have to say anything else. You
No, I think you do. Your perspective is a little bit more important than mine, that's for sure. But I mean, you know, I'm glad it this wasn't directed at Bubba Wallace. Seems like a sharp enough guy. I give him actually some latitude, some space, because I think he's a young man who's focused on racing cars, not focused on the political discussions. And yet he's in his milieu, he's only going to hear one side. And it's this leftist pablum like Don Lemon repeats every night on CNN.
Well, I don't give him any space because this has been our problem for the last 60 years in the black community. When I grew up with men were truly overcoming racism, and not only overcoming it, but winning, and then reaching back to tell their kids you can do the same thing. No, this is a good example of what has been our biggest problem in my race and now in our country. It's called elitism. This guy's a black elitist. The guy literally is making millions of dollars with fan base that has shown that they can care less about his color, and he turns on them. He turns his back on all those people, all those hundreds of thousands of people that supported him, made him wealthy, and now calling them, allowing the Marxists. And that's right, by the way, for those who are chiming in, it doesn't take much, guys, to do some homework. Look into what Black Lives Matter is all about. Look at the seed. They're Marxists, and they are self-proclaimed Marxists. So what Bubba has to understand is one thing. Either he's going to do his homework. I mean, he keeps wealthy enough to now buy a computer and look at Google and find out what these guys are all about. Mm-hmm. Either he's going to stand up against these Marxists, or he's going to be considered one of them. And I want the NASCAR fans to understand very simply, you represent our country, flag, country, family. That's what NASCAR has always been about, and that's why they're going after you guys. That's why they're going after our flag, our churches, our anything that highlights our culture. And old Bubba happens to be a Trojan horse. I have no respect for this young man because he has a chance to be the Jackie Robinson in which you stand up and say, this is what you can be if you love this country. Meritocracy is all about, not just skin color. And he's now becoming very, very wealthy by the leftists. I can guarantee you, if you follow the money, you're going to find out he's going to get a lot of support from leftists.
Well, sure. And the leftists in corporate America in particular, I mean, he's going to drive, you know, he's going to drive a car with the Black Lives Matter on it. And this is going to be an opportunity for corporate America to sponsor Bubba Wallace after all this attention. And sponsor him because he's going to be a vehicle, literally and figuratively, for Black Lives Matter and for assuaging their white guilt by cutting him a check.
Oh, no question. And this is the same thing. Keep in mind, this is these guys do this over and over again. This is the same thing as Kaepernick. You know, the same guy who cannot speak two words without making any sense of what he has. That's why, by the way, you notice you haven't heard anything from old Kaepernick for the last 4 years. Because they understand he cannot speak, he cannot think. So now they're going to use Bubba to be their next Kaepernick. So I'm hoping that those, and I don't know how the NASCAR process works out when people sponsor different cars. I'm hoping that Americans look at who's sponsoring these people, and we need to counsel them. We need to do more about doing what go with them the way they have gone after us. If any corporation supports Black Lives Matter, it means they're supporting Marxists. They have been undermining our country for decades, and all you do is look in the Black community and see how much damage they do by causing misery to get more power. So we need to make sure as Americans, let's stand up for some principles, guys. If we love the sport, we love the game, I guess we love our country more. And I've been taught when I was a kid, you can pull back on things that are temporary to make sure our country survives. So we need to make sure we do that.
When we come back with Burgess Owens, I want to talk a little bit about the NFL, something he knows a lot about as a Super Bowl champion. More with Burgess Owens, former NFL player, as I just mentioned, as well as author of Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism, right after this.
DanProfShow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. We're speaking with Burgess Owens, former NFL player, Super Bowl champion, founder of the National Mentoring Program, Second Chance for Youth, and author of books including Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism, as well as Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. Burgess, talking about Black Lives Matter is where we left off, and the Bubba Wallace case. How about in San Francisco, where the 49ers are flying a Black Lives Matter flag next to the state of California and American flag at Levi's Stadium? The CEO of the 49ers organization saying, we're working with communities to make a difference, allowing players and employees both to let their voices be heard. I love that, let their voices be heard, because what it turns out is we're going to allow voices to be heard so long as they're voices that share a singular opinion. Those voices that don't share the opinion, the Burgess Owens opinions, for example, I'm not so interested in having those voices heard.
No, and just everybody needs to understand, I could have predicted this 4 years ago. What the leftists will always do when it comes down to election time, particularly in something so important to them as beating President Trump, they're going to use and abuse and discard Black America like they never have in the past. Keep in mind, this organization, Black Lives Matter, started by Marxists and funded by white Marxist liberals. These corporations, and by the way, I'm not surprised about 49ers. These are the same people that allowed Marx, Carbon to start this whole process 4 years ago. We have people that hide behind the scenes, and these are the ones that are the biggest bullies and the biggest cowards. They hide behind a brand that they never built. I'm talking about the commissioner, never built, and is designed by the founders to be a one that brings us together and highlights what America does best. That's why we've always gone to these games, and no matter what side of the aisle we're on, we cheer for our team, we stand for the flag, because it means America to all of us. These guys have not only diminished the brand, but they divided our people on purpose, because that's what Marxists do. Look for where the money and look for their power, and you see there's always something behind the curtains that these guys are after. What the NFL is after is not America. They have had a long-term plan to build their business in China and to Mexico and England and Super Bowls all across the country, because it's all about the global greed that they have. And they don't mind putting America under the bus and having this Marxist, Kopernik, as being their brand. The global brand is Kopernik. So you go to China, you see what they're going to be putting up there by Nike, of what the NFL is all about. So right now, this understand it's all about, it's about the greed, it's about the global reach, and they don't mind putting America under the bus, and we need to make sure we stand up against that. Personally, if they do this again, I'm one of those guys who will never, ever watch a game until the commissioner is fired. If enough of Americans feel the same way, we can make this thing happen, and we can make sure that these games are not used to divide us the way these Marxists are doing it right now.
Well, it's somewhat similar to something Jason Whitlock wrote this week, the sports writer, talking about LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick and Megan Rapinoe, and saying, you know, that's all well and good to wear your I Can't Breathe T-shirts and tweet out your hashtags. But why don't you demand that your corporate sponsors, Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, that they onshore manufacturing jobs back in this country? That would really show some leadership that would be a positive impact on regular Americans' lives in terms of job opportunities. But you won't do that, will you? Because you're really in the business to serve your corporate overlords. And it seems that's what the leagues are interested in, as well as the individual players. The virtue signaling is a way for them to essentially buy their way into just serving their corporate overlords at the expense of the fans, really, to some extent.
All of the money. They just did a contract with Goodell a couple of years ago as the interest in America was going down to 14%, I think, $14 billion. He has right now a contract of $40 million per year. 90% of that is based on growth incentives. He's not going to get the growth incentives here in this country. He's going to get the growth incentives by going to China. So understand, it is truly amazing how these globalists put their money and their future and their personal profits over their country. And we need to recognize them for who they are. They're not the proud Americans, the people we're supporting. And Americans need to understand that they're after us. They're after my race, my kids, the black kids that they want to have sitting in, on their helmets versus standing for our flag. That piece of American history, these people are truly anti-American. We need to understand who they are. They can smile as big as they want to, but they're undermining our country. And they're now allowing our cities to burn because they want to make sure there's chaos so they can win in 2020. That's who we're up against.
How did you react to what Brett Favre said earlier this week when he compared Colin Kaepernick to Pat Tillman, saying they were both heroes?
Initially, I was upset, but then I looked at the interview, and I would say this to people like Brett. Brett's probably a good guy. You need to understand that these people will ambush anybody. For those who don't understand American history, black history, instead of trying to be politically correct, which would have worked maybe a few years ago, just say I'll pass on this one. Mm-hmm. Because they mm-hmm. will destroy anyone, in particular liberal. If you think you can navigate your way through political correctness today, forget it. They're going to destroy your reputation, your life, because they want to make sure that everyone understands either you're for them or against them. So my advice to Brett is take a pass next time they try to bring him into this process. If you don't know enough about it, stay on the sidelines. Let those of us who understand it, who are willing to take the heat, stay on the front line. Let us do it and just go ahead and vote for the right people. Vote for Republican this time, not Democrats. These people are not for our country. They're dividing us every chance they get. So
yeah, that's it. He should phone a friend. I agree. Phone Burgess Owens. I know you're the father of six kids. And since this has come back up again against the backdrop of the unrest and all the discussion of police reform, the conversation that black moms and dads have to have with their kids about the police. What was the conversation you had with your six children about the police?
The same conversation I have with my dad, my mom. You respect authority, you respect elders. You learn that the people are people, and there's going to be some knuckleheads out there. And guess what? If whenever I've been stopped, my goal is not to get a ticket. So I'm saying, yes, officer. And if I walk away without a ticket, I am happy. If I don't, if the guy's a jerk, I just ran to a knucklehead. But guess what? If you teach our kids that all police are bad, it is the worst kind of stereotyping. It's what I grew up in. You don't stereotype people based on what they wear or the color of their skin. That is the worst type of prejudice. And we're allowing our kids to be taught that by these hard leftists who hate our country. They want to divide us. So my advice to all Americans, black or white, respect authority, respect people. And be a nice person, and guess what? You will get the greatest pass you'll ever see, no matter what your color is.
And what's your response to those who allege that America is systemically racist, that racism is hardwired into our DNA, there's nothing we can do about it except forever bend the knee to make amends?
Yeah, tell me about that as you look at old millionaire Bubba and our last president, President Obama. No, these guys are so desperate, you got to go out and manufacture racism to prove that there's racism. They cannot find enough Americans that will actually prove their case. They have to go out and manufacture this every 4 years, every 2 years. So, no, keep in mind, it's the same people. The real hard left are the most racist people I'll ever see. They will use and abuse anyone, particularly those that need their help for their gain. So, no, the racists truly are our elitism, the elitists, the black and white elitists that divide our country based on color, race, gender, you name it. They are at it big time, and they all find their way into the Democratic Party. That is a party in every city that Democrats oversee. You see misery. You see division. You see riots. You see craziness. They're pulling down statues now. By the way, Karl Marx said it appropriately. The first battleground is rewriting of history. What the leftists would love to do is take away the we the people history that we've done so well together and replace it with their narrative of a racist country. So let's not let them get away with it, guys. Let's not fall into this white guilt.
He is Burgess Owens, former NFL player, Super Bowl champion, founder of the National Mentoring Program, Second Chance for Youth, author of Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism, and Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. Pick up both of those books. Burgess Owens, thanks for joining us.
Burgess for Utah. I'm running for Congress. We're in the end of our primary.
Yes.
Please support me. All right.
BurgessForUtah.com.
Yes, that's it.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. Good luck with the race. Burgess Owens.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Closing schools was a grievous error, writes Richard Vedder, Forbes, the basis of his assertion, this University of Washington Center on Reinventing Public Education report on the success or lack thereof of the virtual classroom over the last several months to close out the 2019-2020 school year. And we've talked about that report. Only 27% of school districts surveyed, nearly 500 nationwide by University of Washington researchers, 27% required teachers to record whether students even participated in remote classes. From Philadelphia to Boston, half reported, both papers of record there reporting basically half the students participating in online classes or even submitting on or submitting assignments. Yet the teachers unions throughout advocating against adverse grades because of the global pandemic, advocating against grades at all, pass fail at most, lodging their neo-Marxist grievances against those who have disparate access to Wi-Fi. One school district, as the Wall Street Journal reported, the Mountain View Los Altos High School District in California, assigning letter grades to our students is equal to assessing their access to technology, their housing security, and their ableism. So when we talk about, boy, school is going to be different when it resumes, as states are now putting forward the guidelines for the resumption of in-person, in-classroom education. Yeah, it's going to look a lot different in terms of the number of kids that can be in a classroom, in terms of perhaps the school day, a hybrid between in-person versus virtual learning. But as Max Eden points out, it may look a lot different as well because of how emboldened the SJWs in the teaching and administrative ranks have become during this intervening period between the spring and come the fall. For more on that, we're pleased to be joined by Max Eden, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Max, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So before we get into some of the specific examples that support your thesis, your overall sort of impression about what you expect from the K through 12 experience to look like and sound like when kids do return.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you've mentioned, this kind of neo-Marxist social justice warrior rhetoric, it's been in the air for a long time. You know, it didn't just get introduced to the education policy space. But when I've kind of raised the concern to my peers in the past, they've always said, oh, you know, don't worry about it, Max. Yeah, teachers kind of hear this stuff all the time. But at the end of the day, if they get over the line, if they start indoctrinating kids, a kid will tell his parent will tell the principal, the teacher will get in hot water. So teachers really aren't going to do that. And I think what's different now, what's going to be different this fall, is that I don't think that's going to be the case any longer. We're seeing principals, a principal in Vermont get fired for saying all lives matter. If a teacher says it, she ends up in paragraph 3 of the New York Times shame storm story. Hmm. So the kind of parental guardianship that we used to count on as a bulwark against these bad ideas getting too much of an inroad in the classroom, my fear is going to wane as the power of the social media cancel mobs becomes ascendant.
Right. And the interesting thing is the sort of the union collective bargaining agreement, the tenure in a college setting, those are veils that seem to be relatively easily pierced these days if you're piercing it from the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to go a little bit beyond the union at this point, because the unions have been kind of on this train for a long time, the woke train for a long time, right? In 2016,
They had a resolution decrying the institutional racism of American public education, you know, seeming to forget that they are basically the institution. In 2018, you know, they adopted a resolution for professional development on white fragility, which, you know, if your listeners aren't aware, it's first they call you a racist, and then if you agree, that means you're a racist, and if you disagree, that means that you're a racist, and if you don't say anything, that means you're a racist. And if you want to not be a racist, then you need to listen to what the kind of identity politics trainers tell you to think and say. So the unions have been on here for a long time. What's been different and what, you know, was alarming enough for me to want to write an article about it is it's not just the unions anymore. It's the administrative associations, kind of organizations that were previously apolitical, but have now gone whole hog into this idea that we need for schools to become kind of centers of anti-racist training, which of course doesn't mean, you know, not being racist, doesn't mean trying to tell students to respect students without regard for race. It means anything that the trainers say isn't anti-racist is racist.
Yeah, I want to pick it up there because I think new Orwellian nomenclature needs a little bit more development for people to fully appreciate it when they hear it coming back through their kids. Anti-racist versus non-racist. We'll start there with Max Eden, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, right after this. You can never surrender.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with Max Eden, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has penned a must-read piece over at City Journal, city-journal.org. There is no apolitical classroom. This starts with a nice distillation you provided of the difference between being a non-racist versus being an anti-racist. Those are not synonyms to the woke race grievance instructors and intellects.
Yeah, that's correct. Being not racist, encouraging students to not be racist, means not treating students differently if you're a teacher, or, you know, demanding that students treat each other with equal respect. But as they say, there is no not racist. There is only racist and anti-racist. This is not me speaking. These are the theoreticians of anti-racism. And given that all of your actions could help build and maintain a structure of institutional oppression and institutional racism, you need to be vigilant to guard every thought, every action, every interaction through a lens of, am I unintentionally perpetuating a racist system, right? And teachers are being told in kind of Education Week, other organs of teacher opinion, that unless they fully adopt this anti-racist program, unless they check their biases, take implicit bias training, then they are not only racist, but they're actually complicit in the murder of Black men, women, and children daily, either the physical murder or the spiritual murder. And so, you know, when you tell a teacher that if you don't do what I say and tell kids what I say, you're a murderer, most teachers are pretty nice people. They didn't get into the business to murder students. And so they'll end up kind of listening to and following along with the ideology that's on offer for them.
You reference in your piece the National Association of Secondary School Principals, which in a public letter called on school leaders to create, quote unquote, culturally responsive schools. That sounds very Maoist to me.
Well, so the problem is that it might not sound very Maoist to a lot of people, right? It might just sound like, oh, you know, we're trying to meet students where they are a little bit, maybe, you know, use some tools or techniques to draw them in and get them more interested in math and more interested in history. It is actually Maoist to the core, right? The architect of culturally responsive and sustaining education, as it's called, a New York University professor whose work influenced the New York State framework for culturally responsive education, he's the type of guy who will say directly that expecting Black students to speak and read American Standard English is white supremacism. And if, you know, your readers are wondering, well, wait a second, if we don't have students speak English, read English well, doesn't that mean that they won't be able to participate in the economy effectively? And the answer for the culture responses section is yes, but we shouldn't be training these students to participate in an oppressive system. We should be training them to overturn the system, you know, not to be part of the pyramid, as another professor says, but to overturn the pyramid. So what you have is a system of education where teachers are being told to train students to think of themselves as oppressed, to discuss kind of news cycle controversies of the day through the social justice lens of race, class, gender, and think of their work in this country, not, you know, how do we become a good citizen, give back to my fellow man, lead a productive life, have a nice family, but how do I overturn an oppressive system? You know, the problem is it will sound benign to people. We're trying to be responsive to the cultures, but it is, as you said, Maoist to the core.
Well, and the I'm oppressed, or I come from a heritage that was oppressed in this country. Oh, well, okay, well, that doesn't seem too terrible, and you're feeling oppressed. Well, what can I do to allay that feeling? The feeling of oppressed is both debilitating for the person who's been gaslighted into believing they're oppressed, number one. But more importantly, it seems to me that this is all a setup for a claim, right? And this is what we've seen play out. This is a setup to say, based on my self-diagnosed status as oppressed, and oppressed because of some identifying feature I have, my orientation or my skin color or my gender, I now have a legitimate claim to expropriate this or demand that. I mean, ultimately, this is all just the setup to say, you shall distribute the pie thusly, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, take the 1619 Project, for example. Your reader, your audience might be familiar with it. It's this new curriculum from the New York Times Magazine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been a lot of debates over the truth of it, the lies that were told in it, the slanders in it. And that's, frankly, somewhat beside the point of the project. The architect of the project, Nicole Hannah-Jones, has said explicitly that the goal of the 1619 Project, which has been adopted now in 3,500, maybe 4,000 schools across the country, is to argue for reparations. And she says this, she sets that as her goal because she says that that's a more achievable goal than, quote, like, can we stop white people from being white?
Right.
So twofold. One is just the setup for a demand of part of the pie, as you said. The other is just this kind of rhetoric that if we spoke it about any other race would be instantly recognizable as abhorrent. I mean, can you imagine if a principal said, my goal in the school is to get black kids to stop being black? No, it'd be a terrible thing to say.
And yet,
thing to say the other way, but it's said so casually by the people we trust with our kids.
And it'd be one thing if that sort of rhetoric and those sort of positions were, you know, okay, that's your view, and you know, somewhat dismissed or at least responded to proportionally. It's quite another when you have reasonable people, smart people, accomplished people, like BET founder and billionaire Bob Johnson, who essentially adopt Nicole Hannah-Jones's position on reparations minus the racially charged rhetoric.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, and I kind of said this before, but I want to say it again, is it becomes a whole different ballgame when all of a sudden, if you're a teacher, your job security might rest on whether or not you you toe the line on this. I mean, part of the reason I think we've seen the approval for Black Lives Matter skyrocket is because, you know, you'd be surprised how much people can approve of something if questioning it leads to you losing your job.
Or perhaps even worse to some people than they're losing their job is becoming a social pariah.
Yeah. I mean, having everybody pile on to you. I mean, the New York Times had a story on, you know, I think they meant to hold these students up as heroic somehow, but, you know, students creating online mobs to go after people for alleged racial, you know, faux pas and mistakes. And, you know, some of them were serious, you know, shouldn't use the N-word casually, but some of them were just expressions of opinions that up until about 2 months ago were by far the majority American opinion.
He is Max Eden. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. I will tweet out at Dan Prof Show his piece from the City Journal, There Is No Apolitical Classroom. You should check that out, particularly if you have kids in school, but even if you don't. Max, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Take care.
The more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know I love this column, this series that the Wall Street Journal started relatively recently called The Future View, where they ask a salient question of the day and get a selection of responses from college students as well as postgraduate students. Really interesting. So this week is statues. Statues and buildings. How many statues must fall? Should we tear down statues based on the faults of the person memorialized, immortalized? Or do we need some historical context? Arturo Arias Fernandez, who is a public policy major at George Mason University, his response, conversations about removing statues follow a pattern. Historical figure X is deemed a racist, a colonialist, and so forth. Then someone dissents or attempts to introduce nuance. Then the mob calls that person a racist, a colonialist, and so forth. Surely we can do better by considering historical context. Huh. Andrew Nee, New York University business major. Historical figures have complex legacies. For instance, George Washington isn't remembered or revered because he owned slaves. Many people, including many of his contemporaries, have owned slaves. Washington is remembered because he commanded the Continental Army, won the Revolutionary War, and served honorably as America's first president. He's become a symbol of freedom and independence. That's why statues of him were built and why they should stay up. He goes on to invoke Martin Luther King, who spoke at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963 of the Great American, whose Emancipation Proclamation came as a beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice, quoting King. Now, quoting Mr. Nee of New York University, although Abraham Lincoln accepted the white consensus of his time that whites were superior to blacks, King obviously wasn't endorsing that view. He was recognizing that the memorial commemorated Lincoln's principal legacy, not his commonplace views or the entirety of his thinking, but his exceptional work to free the slaves. Very thoughtful comments. I mean, this is some green shoots among the blockheads that are otherwise dominating the headlines, isn't it? Another comment from Jada Badillo, Smith College. We should judge who came before us the same way we hope to be judged in the future. Will our descendants tear down statues of our great leaders years from now for faults that we can't foresee or aren't sure about? And even this, even the person who takes a more skeptical view, Johnny Wren from Brown University, math and economics major, it's valuable to question the status quo. If a longstanding policy or practice is wrong, we should change it. If a statue should no longer stand, we should take it down and let it fall. We owe nothing to the relics of the past, and a fallen statue sheds no tears. Well, I take his point. Yes, it's fine to examine. I mean, I have no particular affinity to Confederate generals, but what's the standard? And what's the process by which we make determinations? A mob with some rope pulling down statues willy-nilly? Being unable to distinguish between a Confederate general and a Union general and president. And somebody, Frederick Douglass, suggested that blacks owed more to him than any other man for freeing the slaves. I'm talking about Ulysses S. Grant. Yeah, the way it's going about and the lack of standards is the problem. And I'll tell you what, it's encouraging that these young people, at least those that made the cut in the Wall Street Journal's Future View column, understand that.
From the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com for podcasts of the program and on social media at Dan Proft Show as well, Facebook and Twitter. New York City beaches are going to open and Texas is going to close. America's schizophrenia when it comes to COVID-19 continues unabated. And some of that is, of course, just indicative of our 50 laboratories of democracy in the labs within the labs charting different courses based on different levels of outbreak, and I understand that. I wish the great swath of the D.C. press corps did, but they don't. Somebody who used to be counted as a member of that group until he was exiled is Alex Berenson. He's a former New York Times reporter. He's the author of Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence, and he has been dogged on the topic of COVID-19. Sifting through the data and trying to synthesize it for easy consumption, which has been quite helpful, although it has not earned him many friends in the CNN New York Times axis. Alex, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good to talk to you.
The thing that is most disquieting to you over the last couple, 3 days, as the conversation from the media has turned again to spikes, particularly in states that opened early. CNN's got their ticker back up. Sanjay Gupta is back on a heavy rotation. And we're going to go back to March as far as the D.C. press corps is concerned.
Sure. So, by the way, I wouldn't say I was exiled from the press corps. I feel the need to sort of tell people this. I left the Times entirely on my own.
No. I mean, just now, like culturally, you're not part of the clique anymore.
Culturally, yes. It was more of a self exile, which has grown.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Sun Belt and what's happening down there, and what we know and what we don't know. What we know is there's been a lot of positive tests especially in the three big states in Florida, Arizona, Texas. And we know that there's been some increase in COVID-related hospitalizations. There's been some increase, at least in Texas and Arizona, in COVID-related ICU hospitalizations, which are concerning. It would be a mistake not to be concerned about that. But the media is sort of looking at the top line increase in cases, again, which are positive tests, and for many people are going to be completely asymptomatic, and saying basically these states are going to look like New York at the end of March in a matter of days or weeks. And there's not really evidence for that. And there's a couple reasons for that. At the peak in New York, hospitalizations were doubling every 2 days. Okay, what we're talking about in Texas and Arizona is that hospitalizations have doubled, or now a little bit more than doubled, since the beginning of June. So it's a different picture. There's a rise in hospitalizations, but it isn't as fast. And there's reasons to believe that the increase in testing positive results is to some extent a fact of state, the fact that it's a result of the fact that states are getting better at testing, that they're testing congregate settings. In other words, might be migrant workers in dormitories, might be people in jails. And some of that is an artifact of the fact that they're getting better at testing. So what we don't know is how bad this really is, and versus how much it is due to changes in testing and changes in the way hospitals are treating these COVID patients. So just one last point on this, which is, but the media just wants to, sort of scream, basically, we are all, we're all going down the rabbit hole, and the only thing to do is lock down again.
Two things. One is the 7-day rolling average of daily deaths, which peaked at about 2210 on April 18th, had fallen to 605 as of Monday. That's a 73% drop, which is what you were saying. Even in Texas, where Abbott is talking about, only go out as necessary, the 7-day average fell from 58 on April 30th, when the statewide lockdown was lifted, to 20 on June 13th, before climbing a little bit this week. I mean, so the second point is not just what you're talking about, which is the possible mutation, but also the point DeSantis made in Florida yesterday, which is the median age of the infected is down from 65 to 37. That's good news, because you're talking about people who are more able to weather the virus if they even show symptoms.
That's right. And in fact, I think it might be down to 35 in Florida now.
So,
the people who are getting this now, for the most part, or certainly the number of people that, the big increase in cases is coming with people who are likely to be mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic. And that's a very good thing. By the way, there's other things that may be going on, too. People have speculated, well, maybe some people are coming over the border from Mexico with COVID to get treatment. I don't know if that's true. And frankly, if you're pretty sick, I think that's probably a hard trip to make. But that's a possibility that could, that could account for some of this. People are saying hospitals are testing everybody who comes in for elective surgery. That's definitely true. And so if you come in for elective surgery and you get a positive test and they decide they're going to hospitalize you, which they have financial and legal incentives to do at this point, as well as medical incentives, then you're going to be a COVID case for a few days. So
I think Chris Cuomo in the background is upset with what you're saying. Is that Chris Cuomo at your place?
Oh no, that's right. And, my daughter is she's a lot tougher than Chris Cuomo.
Some other things, we continue to learn about this. I know people get stuck in their position and they're just unwilling to to look at what is being researched and some of the results of that research, but we probably should do that. There's a couple of working papers out from the National Bureau of Economic Research, which are always fun reads, as you know. But one from MIT finds that something we sort of knew, but it's a little bit more nuanced. We find that higher amounts of commuting via public transportation relative to telecommuting is correlated with higher death rates. The correlation between driving into work and death rates is also positive across the models that they examine. We find that a higher share of people not working and thus not commuting is correlated with higher death rates than those working but telecommuting, which is sort of interesting, too. And then one other thing on race, and this is from University of Virginia researchers. They find that for all minorities, the minority's population share is strongly correlated with total COVID deaths. For Hispanic, Latino, Asian minorities, those correlations are fragile, largely disappear when we control for education, occupation, and commuting patterns. Also, surprisingly, for African Americans and First Nations populations, the racial disparity does not seem to be due to differences in income, poverty rates, education, occupational mix, or even access to health care insurance. A significant portion of the disparity could be sourced at the use of public transit. So, again, we have either not working and sort of vegetating or using public transit as part of your work, either prior or now post lockdowns. That it has there's strong correlations with increased risk of infection and death. I just think that's interesting. I haven't really heard anybody talk about sort of that layering in terms of trying to understand where people are most vulnerable, where the spread can be the greatest outside of nursing homes.
Yes. I mean, there's been a real serious problem with reporting on this from the beginning. And unfortunately, in some ways, it's gotten worse as the issues have gotten more subtle and complicated, because the media does not want to look and say, you know, do the on the ground work of talking to, you know, nurses and physicians at, let's say, in Baylor Medical or in Dallas or in Miami. They just want to point at the case counts right now and say everything is terrible. And they want to say there's racial disparities here, but not say, well, are there issues in comorbidities that might be driving that? Are there issues in public transportation, as you just mentioned? Last month's shibboleth was, we have to have more testing. We have to have test, trace, and isolate. You know, this month is, we have to have masks. And I'm not saying, by the way, that masks definitely don't work. But what I'm saying is that the evidence on masks is very weak. It's probably nearly as weak as the evidence that lockdowns work. And so the media just kind of lurches from one talking point to the next, almost in unison, instead of doing real reporting, which is what we desperately need here.
And it seems to me on the mask issue, I mean, they just lost credibility, as have a lot of public health professionals and the profession of being an infectious disease expert, when you make excuses for people not wearing masks and congregating in crowds based on what they're congregating in crowds to do or to protest.
Yes, yes. And I had seen this thing in the New York Post, which I almost didn't believe, but apparently it's true that this county in Oregon has mandated masks, but not for African-Americans.
Because it could be racially profiled and attacked by police. Right.
I mean, it's bizarre. I mean, either people need to wear masks or they don't.
He is Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, author of Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. Alex, thanks for joining us, and good luck with the caretaking. Yes.
Thank you, man. Great to talk to you.
Take care.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Still a lot of optimism about our recovery, although some people are getting shaky about whether we're going to see a long plateau with COVID-19 cases and thus a extended time period for recovery, more of an L-shaped recovery, not a U-shaped recovery, V-shaped recovery, probably off the table. Okay, I'll stop doing geometry now. Jim Cramer, Mad Money Cramer over on CNBC, pointed this out. This is what he expects, what he sees with respect to travel. You know, the airlines are big industries, big employers, and he doesn't see a snapback for the airlines coming anytime soon because of the lack of corporate travel.
I think it's really important that that part of the equation is not, I don't think it's going to come back very fast. I don't think people want to see you. I think people are much more fearful than Washington makes it sound like. If you can use Zoom or WebEx to get the deal done and everyone else is using WebEx, it means your competition is the same. I think it's more of that when you get there, no one wants to be with you. And I think we have to start understanding, unless everyone wears masks, and there's unified, a unified decision from Washington that everyone must wear masks, I think that travel by corporate travel is just not going to come back the way people think. It's just too dangerous.
So the fear factor is being underestimated. Corporate travel not going to come back. Addition of President Trump suspending H-1B and H-2B visas through the end of the year. Some would argue, I would be among them, that is not going to aid the pace of recovery either. Another stimulus, is that the order of the day? That seems to be what is being discussed, although those around him of the free market variety, the Steve Moores and the Art Laffers and the Larry Kudlows, have suggested that now is the time for the government to stop spending and get out of the way so the private sector can resume producing. Well, how to make sense of it all. To help us, the aforesaid Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, and author of Trumponomics, joins us. Steve, help.
Right on the subject of what you were talking about, Dan, we have a study coming out this week that is that I've done with Casey Mulligan. He's at the University of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
So I'll give you the sneak preview because I think it's going to get a lot of attention. I think it'll be in the Wall Street Journal in the next few days. That what we find is that if you do there's two competing stimulus plans. That one is the payroll tax cut that the aforementioned Steve Forbes and Art Laffer and I and Larry Kudlow and most importantly Donald Trump have been in favor of, which would basically be to suspend the payroll tax for the rest of the year. So you're giving every worker a 7.5% pay raise and every employer a 7.5% cut. We've talked about that on the show in previous weeks. And then the other proposal is the one that is in Nancy Pelosi's bill to pass through the House, which would be to extend the unemployment benefits that pay people, 4 out of 5 workers, more money for not working than working. And so we put those side by side, and here's what we found, that if you do the Trump plan of repealing the payroll tax for the rest of the year, you create about 2.5 to 3 million more jobs than otherwise would happen. That's a lot. That's a lot of jobs, 2.5 to 3 million. If you do the Pelosi plan, what do you think happens, Dan?
You lose jobs and you continue to have double digit unemployment and you continue to have GDP and cratering.
Yeah. So, you get your A in economics today. But here's the number, though. Here's the number we came up with. And it's actually a conservative forecast. We believe that if you pass the Pelosi bill and the Senate, which passed the House, put it into law, you would lose 10 million jobs. 10 million jobs, by the way, is larger than the entire working population of Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana combined. That's how many jobs you would lose if you do the Pelosi plan. So there is a stimulus plan and there's an anti-stimulus plan, and we better get this right.
Well, there doesn't seem to be much chance that the Pelosi plan would pass the Senate, I would hope. But the problem is that there's
you never know the way these Republicans negotiate.
Well,
you know, I mean,
yeah.
I think look, if I were the Republicans, I would say not one more day. We should not have these extra unemployment benefits. It's causing big problems. We have 30 million unemployed people today in the United States. And you know what the problem is? You go around the country, you see help wanted signs. Businesses are ready to hire back people, and they can't get them back on the job.
The White House has to have a sense of, from McConnell, of what Senate Republicans are willing to do and perhaps willing to concede to get the version of the stimulus, I mean, to get the stimulus, what you were describing, passed, and not to start from the premise of the anti-stimulus to pass something that advances Nancy Pelosi's flag. I mean, is there an understanding of that approach?
Yeah, I think there is. I think that the Republicans do understand that doing anything that would expand and extend those unemployment benefits would be catastrophically bad for the economy. It would mean that there would be no recovery. And by the way, I've become cynical. I have to admit, I think that's why Pelosi isn't that stupid. I think she understands exactly what she's doing. That, that wouldn't be such a bad thing if we went into the election and there are 10 million people in the unemployment line that wouldn't otherwise be there. There is an Operation Chaos going on out there, folks, and it is very evident from everything that is going on. And I'll give you another example of this because it really hits the economy. All of these news stories about the second wave of coronavirus are complete nonsense. There are more cases. Here's the headline. It should be the headline in every newspaper every single day. Death rates from coronavirus from its heights are down 90%. Why is that not the headline across the country?
Mm-hmm. Have you and your Green Eye Shades boys looked at what this does, this idea of cities, big cities like Chicago and states, really across the country, except for the states that never locked down, allowing businesses to reopen, but at 25 and 50% capacity, what that does to the rate of recovery? I mean, the Fed was predicting we're going to have north of 9% unemployment nationally by year's end. We'll be down to 9%. But it seems to me that that's a rosy scenario for operating at a quarter or half capacity. You're not going to get a quarter or half of the productivity. You're going to get less.
Yeah, I tend to be with you. I mean, I know you're a rosy optimist on the show every week, but I'm kind of with you, Dan. I think people really overestimated how, you just played that clip from Kramer. And I think he's right. I mean, the airline industry isn't going to be back to anywhere normal for another year, 6 months at least. And so, major industries are really hurting. And you're right. How do you run on a restaurant? I bet there are about a lot of people who are listening to the show either work at or own a restaurant. You can't make a profit at 50%. I mean, unless you're incredibly efficient. So that's a big problem. That's why we have to overcome this fear element. And I do think there's this kind of sense of, I have relatives who are like, oh, I can't go out of my house. And it's like, come on, let's get back to some sense of normalcy. We do know a lot more about the disease than we do. And by the way, the 10 states, I know we're running out of time here, so I'll leave you with one other one. The 10 states that have the highest death rates from, as a share of their population. Ready? New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Washington State, Rhode Island. What do all those states have in common?
Democrat governors.
Well, actually, I think one exception.
Oh, Massachusetts is Baker.
Republican governor. But, so not only did the 10 bluest states, those 10 states have the highest unemployment rates, but they also have the highest death rates. So they say, we tolerate higher unemployment because we're not trying to keep our people safe. Gee, they're doing a great job of it.
Yeah, nice twofer. All right.
And by the way, Pritzker is near the top of that list, folks.
Illinois is always near the top of any list when it comes to being the bad example. You know that. Steve Moore, keep cracking skulls inside the Beltway. Thanks for joining us, Steve. Appreciate it.
All right. See you guys.
The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Dr. Wayne Frederick, he writes in a piece at Higher Education, he sees universities as think tanks of America. He said in this discussion, he believed all higher education institutions had to be at the forefront of providing solutions to tackle racism. He believes Howard University, where he is the president, is at the tip of the spear there. Well, let's have that discussion then. We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick. He's the president of Howard University. Dr. Frederick, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So universities need to be at the forefront of providing solutions to tackle racism. Do you have a one or two solutions in mind, and have you seen them implemented on the college campuses anywhere to the effect of reducing racism and improving cohesion?
I think our universities should be providing solutions. We should take our protests and turn them into policy, and Howard University has a strong history of doing that. If we go back to the 1950s, Brown versus the Board of Education, several Howard University lawyers and members of the law school faculty participated in that activity to bring about that law, Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, that resulted in the desegregation of our education system. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, an example of where our university and, in general, our universities can provide that help, and especially being the cauldron for where young people really form their ideas and their personalities. I think we have a major opportunity there as well to get them to participate in the general society in the way that we would like them to.
Well, that's a great example of Brown v. Board of Education, seminal case to relegate to the ash heap of history this notion of separate but equal. And yet fast forward to 2020 America, and Evergreen State University has a blackout day, whites off campus. This was what led to Brett Weinstein's confrontation with students at Evergreen State University, with which I'm sure you're familiar. And we see in the autonomous zone in Seattle doing the same thing, a space for black people only. So all that effort, which it, frankly still needs to go on because so many cities like the one we live in, Chicago, are de facto segregated. So all that emphasis on desegregation and integration and equality before the law and eliminating separate but equal. And yet we have on campuses and to some extent in larger society a push for de facto resegregation.
Well, you know, I think part of it obviously is that people are going to protest when we don't get what we want in terms of a completeness of the outcome. And so, yes, that does result in a push that where the pendulum swings too far. And clearly in those instances that you're mentioning, the pendulum has swung too far. But we have to be mindful that the pendulum didn't get there on its own. It got there because of constant ignoring of what we felt was necessary, even in terms of the desegregation of our schools. If you look in the South, there are more schools with 75% of one race or another than there were before Brown versus the Board of Education. So as a society, we have set up systems that have gotten us there. Again, I'm not necessarily saying that for that or not, but I think that is what does happen in our system. It happens in our electoral system. In terms of elections, you get a black president, and unfortunately or fortunately for some, that leads to the election of a president that looks exactly opposite to him as a correction. And November's election may again result in another swing back as people have seen something that they probably don't want. So it is about some of that balance as well.
Do you think that it's all of this is explained through a racial prism, or is it a socioeconomic prism, as, for example, Bob Woodson would argue, who spent the last 40 years of his life at the Woodson Center trying to advance the interests of people who are in poverty, white, black, Latino, and otherwise? Because it seems to me that there's a real policy divide and there's a real cultural divide, and it revolves maybe more around the level of education than it does the particular race of a person or the socioeconomic profile of a person, more so than the race of a person, even though I understand minorities are disproportionately at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder.
I think it's a mixture of both. We have to always remember, as uncomfortable as a discussion about slavery is, it was an economic impetus. And even at the end of slavery, people were compensated for giving up their slaves. So there has always been an economic underpinning of why slavery existed. And as a result, that economic underpinning, even as you undid slavery to emancipation, you still needed a system that created an unequal setup for the economics and the finances to still work. And so we get into Jim Crow, et cetera. A lot of this is based on economics. When you look at housing discrimination through the 20s all the way into the 60s and 70s, again, a system that benefited one social group versus another. And yes, you're right. Some of those economic things have no race, but they disproportionately affect African Americans. And so I think there's a mix of both.
When we come back with Dr. Frederick, I want to ask about something that Professor Walter Williams pointed out about black K through 12 schools during Jim Crow as compared to today. More with Dr. Wayne Frederick from Howard University coming up next.
And I'm giving it my all, I'm not the guy you're taking home.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Dr. Wayne Frederick, president of Howard University. And before the break, we were talking about the racial prism versus the socioeconomic prism in terms of understanding what's happening in society. And I want to get to something that George Mason economics professor Walter Williams points out in a recent column. From the late 1800s to 1950, some black schools were models of academic achievement in spite of institutional racism, racism under the law, subjugation of black Americans under the law. He notes black students at Washington's Dunbar High School often outscored white students as early as 1899. Schools such as Frederick Douglass in Baltimore, Booker T. Washington in Atlanta, PS 91 in Brooklyn, and others operated a similar level of excellence. What's happened to K through 12 education? Why have we seen so little progress, in many respects regression, 120 years later?
Yeah, well, when we look at the funding of our school system, it has become politically charged. And as a result of that, the mix of that and housing discrimination, the poverty within those areas and the breakdown of the family have all contributed to a difficult path in terms of us trying to get students through that system. And what we have seen today, for instance, on Howard's campus, we have a middle school. And those students who come to our middle school, it's a charter school, they come by lottery, they tend to perform below their grade when they get to Howard. By the time they leave and go off to all these different high schools, at the end of that period, 95% of them over a 15-year period end up going to college, with about 60% of them choosing STEM disciplines and some 88% of them getting scholarships. Mm-hmm. They will, if you stop one of those kids on my campus today and ask them where they go to school, they'll tell you, I go to Howard University. Just putting them in that environment every day, having to come and walk around a college campus to attend school, gives them confidence. And I think the one ingredient that our school system often misses, regardless of how you bring that ingredient in, whether it's with new facilities, good teachers, or the environment around them, is confidence. Once you instill confidence in a young child, it goes a long way in terms of their academic achievement.
Well, so then you, based on that, would be a proponent of rethinking how we're doing sort of command control K through 12 education, particularly in urban centers. It's not working, clearly.
It's not working, but I think it's also complicated. When you look at where people go to school, I mean, Washington, D.C. is a classic example. You have pockets in this area where the D.C. public school system has some very excellent schools, but what you quickly see is a clustering of residents around that particular school.
Right.
Housing prices going up through the roof. And essentially, those parent teachers associations become almost semi-private associations. So it's a matter of who can afford. And as those residents
right.
who lived there before get displaced, you have an undoing of the system. So you need a leveling of the system with funding throughout that's more consistent and even. And you also need the other social determinants of success, such as food insecurity, et cetera, to be addressed as well.
Well, I mean, so if the system in which Howard University operates, the collegiate system, if that works for post K through 12 education, why wouldn't it work for K through 12 education? Meaning marginal students that are being marginalized because of their household income and their address should have the same opportunity as people that are come from wealthier households. What's so complicated about that?
Yeah, great question. What's complicated about it is that Howard University is unique in that we are getting, to some extent, the cream of the crop. We get 25,000 applications. When we look at the SAT scores and GPAs of our incoming class, they are about 300 points higher on the SAT score than the average African-American student in that income bracket. And when you look at standardized tests that are already culturally biased and skewed, we clearly are getting a very unusual, high-performing, low-income student. So I often tell people I want to be cautious when you even look at Howard University as an experiment. There's several things about Howard University that's unusual. We employ more African-American faculty than any other tertiary institution in this country.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, I concede your point about Howard and its sort of unique success in American history. But, you know, hey, not everybody gets to go to Howard. Not everybody gets to go to Harvard. Not everybody gets to go to Northwestern. But you know what? You get a good education at Illinois or Illinois State or Michigan State or Iowa or wherever. So, I mean, it's not that everybody gets to go to Harvard just like everybody gets to go to the best high school in a particular city or a particular state. It's the fact that you have better Correct. Educational options that are better fits for you. You have choice where you don't have that in most urban centers outside of those that have advanced opportunity scholarship programs.
Yeah, I'm not saying no. I think the point I was trying to make is that the funding of that still needs to be normalized, right? So Howard University sends more African Americans to medical school as an example. But when you look at our endowment against the endowment of much larger institutions or better funded institutions, for what the country gets, the return on that investment is not even. And so what we do in terms of what we are able to supply is very, very different. So all I'm saying is that I do agree with you that if the fundamentals of providing that education on an even basis are adopted, and then we fund those things appropriately, we can get there. Absolutely agree with you.
Ian Rowe, who has run a successful charter school operation in the South Bronx, mostly Black and Latino students, writing in the Wall Street Journal this week, the narrative that white people hold the power conveys a wrongheaded notion of white superiority, creates an illusion of Black dependency on white largesse. This false assignment of responsibility, while coming from an authentic desire to produce change, can create a kind of new mental enslavement. Do you agree that so much of the conversation really removes agency from Black Americans, trivializes them, really marginalizes them, and that is unhelpful?
Yeah, you certainly don't want to remove agency, and I absolutely agree with that. You don't want to, but let's be sure that we are going to be objective about how that agency was removed in the first place, or whether or not somebody is actually trying to replace agency that has already been removed. I think in some of these circumstances, the agency has already been removed or degraded in such a way that there is no agency to speak of, and that some of the advocacy that is required was necessary because you have a subset of people who are now in a circumstance in which they cannot move forward or move into circumstances that would be for their betterment unless somebody else advocates or unless the system is changed. So I just want to be, I absolutely agree. You don't want to remove the agency, but I'm just not sure that in all these circumstances, the agency really does exist, though.
Dr. Frederick, let's hold it right there. When we come back, I want to ask you about the charge that America is systemically racist and how that argument holds up against a review of the number of Black Americans in positions of authority, in elective office and other positions of authority. More with Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick coming up next.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Wayne Frederick. He's the president of Howard University. And Dr. Frederick, I want to examine this charge that America is systemically racist, particularly with a little bit of historical context, just looking at sort of one indicator, just one. But one metric is the level of African-American representation in positions of authority, power, elective office, for example. And obviously, that has increased exponentially over the last 50 years. And yet again, where you have a disproportionate location of minorities in urban centers around the country, there doesn't seem, despite the Great Society funding and the greater presence of Blacks in positions of authority, there doesn't seem to be great improvement in the areas of education and economic opportunity and public safety. How do you explain that?
Right. So a couple of things, I think, when you look at this. So, for instance, in elected public offices, especially if you look at the U.S. Congress, 40% of the African Americans in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate attended historically Black colleges and universities. Those historically Black colleges and universities account for only 3% of the institutions in our country, but are responsible for 22% of all of the African Americans in this country who receive bachelor's degrees, and in the STEM disciplines account for 34%. So if you look at judges, 80% of them who are African-American have attended historically Black colleges and universities. So the point being that we have moved an undue burden onto one very small, under-resourced segment of the society to get there and to springboard there. So what you're seeing in terms of that springboard is really a concentrated effort in one area, unfortunately, at the tertiary education level, And so some of that, some of what you see in terms of the lack of balance is that you don't have enough voices to lift up and say that. The other thing is, I think our history is uneven. Prior to Jim Crow, we don't tell the history of the black congressmen and members of the House of Representatives and so on in this country. And I also think that that's a missed opportunity as well, in terms of us recognizing as a nation that prior to that era, we did have some representation and we did have some progress that was stymied by the Jim Crow era. And as we look at this era as well, and we look at the advances that you're talking about in terms of public safety and education, there's a much larger, complicated system that one or two people cannot overthrow. And you can't expect that those one or two people only come to 3% of the higher ed institutions in this country. That's an undue burden, especially for an under-resourced segment.
He is Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick. He is the president of Howard University. Dr. Frederick, pleasure to talk to you. I hope to do it again soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Same here. Appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Take care.
Fake news. He's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, where we have a number of legal issues to go over with our next guest, starting with news that broke today. That news, a federal appeals court in D.C. by a 2-1 vote, U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, directing U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan to dismiss the charges against General Michael Flynn that the Department of Justice had tried thus far in vain to dismiss, suggesting what I think is relatively obvious. It surely was obvious to Barr, but just sort of as a matter of course, that the judge isn't supposed to play the role of prosecutor. That's essentially what the U.S. District, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ruled. And we start there with John Yoo. He is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the soon-to-be-released Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Dan. Anytime.
Your view on the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., their decision on the Flynn case?
I think they reached the right call. If you look at the opinion, it makes clear that the power to prosecute is an executive power. It's given in the Constitution to the president and the president alone. And what the court says is if the president, acting through the Justice Department, chooses to drop charges, the defendant certainly not going to complain. They agree, Mr. Flynn here agreed the charges should be dropped. Then there's no case. And if there's no case, under the Constitution, the courts have no role to step in and force the executive branch to continue prosecuting case that it doesn't want to. So in normal times, with a normal defendant, this would be an easy case. Wouldn't even require all the attention and ever go up to the D.C. Circuit and maybe even to the Supreme Court still. The only reason it's there is because this involves General Flynn and accusations of corruption and the Russia collusion probe, which turned out to be groundless against President Trump.
I mean, not to prolong this saga any longer, but I mean, Judge Sullivan is so far out of bounds. And by the way, whichever appellate court judge it was that voted to uphold Judge Sullivan's decision in the case, I mean, they're so far out of bounds. This is not a close call, is it? This is something that it seems to me they should be the subject of professional sanction.
It's not a close call. If you look at the opinion, there are numerous cases in the Washington, D.C. federal court saying the court's role here, actually, it's the opposite of what this judge, Judge Sullivan, wanted to do. The only time a federal judge would really review the dropping of charges is to make sure the prosecution's not dropping the charges and then bringing them again, dropping them, bringing again. It's to protect the defendant. It's not to launch some kind of expedition on the part of a federal judge to satisfy his curiosity about why a president decides to drive charges or not. It's quite an intrusion into the executive branch and really unwarranted expansion in judicial power. And if Judge Sullivan had not been slapped back here, he would have kept going, right? He wanted to appoint former judges to be sort of pretend faux prosecutors. He wanted to have multiple hearings. He wanted to drag this thing out for months. So it's a very good thing that the D.C. Circuit stepped in here and called the circus to a halt.
Speaking of incursions into the executive branch, it seems that Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts is guilty of that as well in his decision on DACA, where he essentially, as I understand from reading it, argues that a president can act unconstitutionally, but a subsequent president can't undo that unconstitutional act by a previous president without going through some administrative bureaucratic process.
Well, Dan, I give you an A for that. You really read the opinion quite well.
Okay, thank you. Now explain to me how that's possible. Okay.
This is a real, now there's one bad way to read it and even a worse way to read it. The bad way to read it is Trump still could undo President Obama's illegal DACA and DAPA order, but it would take a year or two. That's one thing the Supreme Court said. But think about that. The worst version, which is what you just set out, is that means a president could do something illegal, clearly illegal, runs against the Constitution. The Constitution here gives the power of immigration to Congress. It doesn't say the president can decide visa categories and change the number of people out in the country. That's only up to Congress. So the president could do something unconstitutional and illegal, and can do it for years and years. And then a new president comes in, and he wants to obey the Constitution. Here, Trump wants DACA. He just wants it done the right way. He wants it done through Congress. And according to the court, the president has to keep doing an unconstitutional thing for a year or two. That is incredible. In fact, I think that violates the president's oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. And it offends the president's duty to take care of the laws are faithfully executed. It's incredible.
Maybe that'll be the basis for his next impeachment that he's following. I mean, this is so this is just incredible. And also, too, I mean, not that this was necessary, but it just adds to the absurdity of the Roberts opinion, which is, I mean, President Trump a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, was in negotiations with Congress on DACA. He was willing to grant some extended status to the 700,000 DACA designees. Then he went further and said, not only will I do that if you give me border wall funding, I'll grant some extended status to the additional 1.1 million individuals in this country who could be eligible for DACA but didn't apply. So, I mean, that this is the negotiation and the bartering between the executive and the legislative branch. There was no reason for the court to get involved.
But 2 points. One is it's actually worse than that because you're right. Congress and the president were negotiating over this. When the court steps in like this, the court torpedoed all the negotiations.
Right.
If you're the Democrats, you would sit there and say, why should we negotiate at all? The court is going to give us everything we want. Which they did. And then the second thing is, I think, I have a piece up at Newsweek just an hour ago saying, well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Why doesn't President Trump use this new power too? So I say President Trump should cut all taxes in the country by 50%. He could just say like Obama did, pay what you want, pay 50% of what you owe. I'm not going to enforce the tax laws anymore. And this will be a great jump start to the economy. And I'm going to give you a permit. And I'm going to order the IRS not to pursue anybody. And I'm going to cite the DACA opinion as my authority. It's exactly the same thing Obama did with DACA.
I love it. And then if you don't like that, then elect Joe Biden. And in a year or two, after he goes through the administrative process, he may be able to unwind it.
Right. So Trump's tax cuts could be good for 2 to 3 years. He doesn't need Congress.
I like it. Well, that's the cunning thinking of a law professor. I like it. I wanted to get your take on something else, another case. And Ilya Soman, who's a law professor at George Mason University, as you know, wrote about this in Reason Magazine, noting this week the 15th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Kalo decision, Kalo versus City of New London, which was, interestingly, as Professor Soman notes, was acknowledged as an error by Justice John Paul Stevens, who wrote the majority opinion in the case after its decision. But this was the court's really expansion of the definition of public use such that it allowed the government to seize property and turn it over to private hands, which runs afoul of, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment takings clause for starters. But the 15th anniversary of that, Soman actually gives an interesting perspective, suggesting that, you know, the flip side of that terrible decision was that it generated more laws to protect private property at the state and local level than any other case in U.S. history. And so it actually had the interesting net effect of perhaps having private property rights more protected at the state and local level because of this terrible Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't forget that the case was wrong, utterly wrong. As you say, there's so many states rose up and changed their own state constitutions to give more protections for property that it showed that just the overwhelming majority of Americans thought the decision was wrong. But we shouldn't forget the case was a mistake, because what that case did was it basically said it was okay for a city here in New London, but could be any city mm-hmm. in the country, just to take property from one private person and give it to another private person because it feels like it. And that's something that our founders repeatedly said was unconstitutional, what the Takings Clause was against. But the court said, we can't tell why the city did that, so we're just going to say whenever the city does it, it's a public purpose. I think it was terribly wrong, and I would like to see the court someday overrule that mistaken decision.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice, especially since you have the rare circumstances as mentioned, where John Paul Stevens admitted that he misinterpreted precedent on the case. I mean, so it'd be nice to see the Supreme Court correct its mistakes and then not require, you know, decades and decades like it took, 56 years for them to correct separate but equal and plus E.V. Ferguson to Brown versus Board of Education. You'd like for the court to be a little bit quicker to remedy its wrongs, right?
Well, it's Chicago's fault because that's where John Paul Stevens was from.
Oh, I know, Northwestern, my alma mater, even worse. Professor John Yu, the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of Cal Berkeley, author of the soon-to-be-released Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. Professor Yu, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure. Anytime.
Take care. Don't you forget about me.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, and let's talk about the purge. We'll get to James O'Keefe and Project Veritas, and they've done it again with a Facebook whistleblower. Some important reporting there from O'Keefe and the gang. But first, President Trump at the Turning Point USA student convention yesterday in Phoenix, saying this about the purge and the mobsters that are orchestrating the purge. And I do mean that in the Soviet sense of the word.
They want to take down Ulysses S. Grant. Well, he's the one that stopped the Confederates, right? So nobody's stock went higher than his stock over the last 10 or 15 years.
But do you understand how you look at Thomas Jefferson, you look at George Washington, look at James Monroe, look at James Madison? One thing they had, they were brilliant. They also had slaves.
Yeah.
So how do we grow as a country, but yet not forget our past?
You have to understand history, and you have to understand the culture and so many other aspects of our country. And people can study that, and they can hate it, and let's all hate it. But you can't take down George Washington's statue, and half of our country is named after Washington. You can't. We have to remember the heritage, the culture of our country. And, you know, this is less important, but it's very important. Some of the things that they're trying to destroy are magnificent pieces of art.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty is an aspect of it. And that was obviously Trump with Brian Kilmeade. We'll get to his remarks at the Turning Point USA Student Convention momentarily. Trump with Brian Kilmeade from Fox and Friends talking about American heritage. And very much like early in the program from the Future View column in the Wall Street Journal, you heard from young people saying the same thing. Historical context matters. We don't remember and celebrate George Washington because he owned slaves, but because he was the commander of the Continental Army, because he won the Revolutionary War, because he served admirably as the nation's first president, because he is a human symbol of freedom and the idea of America as enshrined in our founding documents, even when we've failed to live up to those ideals in those founding documents. That is not a complicated position. Certainly not as complicated as the mob would have you suggest, or wrongheaded. Now, Trump at Turning Point talking about the aforesaid mob.
You're fighting against an oppressive left-wing ideology that is driven by hate and seeks to purge all dissent. The radical left demands absolute conformity from every professor, researcher, reporter, journalist, corporation, entertainer, politician, campus speaker, and private citizen.
That is certainly a description of what we're seeing. We'll get to a list of some of those who've been purged across all of those sectors momentarily. One more thing Trump said to the kids at Turning Point USA. Talk about historical context.
The left-wing mob is trying to demolish our heritage so they can replace it with a new repressive regime that they alone control. They're tearing down statues, desecrating monuments, and purging dissenters. It's not the behavior of a peaceful political movement. It's the behavior of totalitarian.
That's exactly what it is. Give you an example of the purging that's going on and the denunciations not coming from government, but coming from Marxists throughout our culture. An excellent piece by Ira Stahl in both the New York Sun and as well as The Future of Capitalism. The list of people who have been canceled in the post-George Floyd anti-racism purges. The president and board chairman of the Poetry Foundation. Board chairman is Henry Beenan, who actually was the Northwestern University president. Was he, I think, my senior year at Northwestern and went on to be president there for some time. They said the call for more poetry that more reflect the challenges of racism and other oppressive structures, as so some of the Poetry Foundation members said. The statement that the president and the board chairman issued that critics said was vague and lacking any commitment to concrete action. So they forced them out. The editor-in-chief of the food magazine Bon Appetit, Adam Rappaport, after a photo surfaced of him dressed in a racially insensitive comment from 2004. The head of video at Condé Nast, Matt Ducker, whose critics said he presided over a racially biased compensation system. We've talked about some of these. The top editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Stan Wisnowski, over a headline that read, "Buildings Matter Too." David Shore, a political data analyst, was fired for having tweeted out a summary of a paper by a Princeton sociology professor. John Cochran, over at University of Chicago, writing about, he's at the Hoover Institution now, but writing about University of Chicago professor economics Harold Ulig, placed on his leave from his role as editor of the Journal of Political Economy following accusations of discriminatory conduct in the classroom. He also had his contract with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago canceled after his views were determined not to be compatible with the Chicago Fed's values. What did he do? He tweeted out criticism of the idea of defunding the police. Too bad, but Black Lives Matter, per its core organization, just torpedoed itself with its full-fledged support of defund the police. We call for a national defunding of the police, quote unquote. Sure. They know this is a non-starter and tried a sensible Orwell 1984 way of saying it. And then he goes on to make his point. And, the point that John Cochran makes in his write-up on this is that no one's safe. The purge. There's another dozen or so that I will tweet out from this piece at thefutureofcapitalism.com. That should be chastening for those who think that this can't happen to them or think this is isolated. It's just one after the other. A Canadian television personality, an ABC News executive, emergency room doctor in Ohio, a St. John's University assistant fencing coach. Are these all, people running around burning crosses and using the N-word? Hardly. Hardly. And with respect to Project Veritas and Facebook, just quickly on this, wish we had more time, but James O'Keefe got a Facebook whistleblower, as he's so good at doing, Zach McElroy, who said what's going on at Facebook is not exactly what Mark Zuckerberg testified as to before Congress in terms of the disposition of Facebook with respect to their content moderation.
What percentage of the flagged posts in the civic harassment queue, as it's called, were Republican conservative?
I saw a stark contrast between Republicans versus Democrats in that queue. I saw upwards of 75% to 80% of the posts in that queue were from Republican pages, politicians, journalists, and pages that supported the president or supported conservatives.
What does that tell you about Facebook / Cognizant's algorithm here?
Well, certainly the algorithm is not human, but it had to be made by a human. So for 75 to 80% of the posts to be targeting Republicans and conservatives, you can say it was a bot, but somebody had to design that algorithm. So really, somebody at Facebook.
Right, and he's got undercover video of a bunch of other content moderators talking about how they take down anything that's conservative or anything that's pro-Trump, and they don't care what the Facebook rules and protocols are with respect to content moderation. So again, we want all voices to be heard except those that have the wrong opinion. It's totalitarian. All of these examples of people being purged out of their positions for innocuous matters of disagreement, not transgression. It's totalitarian. That's exactly what President Trump told those young people at Turning Point USA.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, picking up on the conversation we were having before the break about the ongoing purge. I just wanted to reference this observation from John Cochran, who, again, was a professor at UFC's Booth School of Business in Chicago before going west, young man, and becoming a scholar at the Hoover Institution. He's the grumpy economist. You've heard him on the show before. He says of the time in which we live, I spent much of my last few years of teaching afraid that I would say something that could be misunderstood and thus be offensive to someone. Many of my colleagues report the same worries. And they're not worried, if I could interpret what Professor Cochran is saying a bit, they're not worried that they may offend somebody. They're not worried about what's in their heart or their head. They're worried about the consequences of the grave sin of offense, what it would mean for them professionally and personally, what it would mean for their family if the mob sets upon them. That's what he's talking about. And that's what we're seeing. And for more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined again by Lionel Shriver. She is a contributor to The Spectator, and she is the author of the recently released The Motion of the Body Through Space, which we'll talk about a little bit. You know Mrs. Shriver from best-selling novels, including one that was optioned into a movie that I know about, We Need to Talk About Kevin. Remember that one? That Tilda Swinton played the mom in that? Really, really good. Anyway, Lionel Shriver, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So you write in The Spectator about some of the marches that we've seen, and you contend that marching against racism is too easy. What do you mean by it's too easy?
Well, I'm sympathetic with the initial sense of indignation that gave rise to what seemed like spontaneous protests over the George Floyd murder.
Mm-hmm.
But as they carried on, they seemed to become a kind of activity for their own sake. I think that they offered an opportunity to get out of the house. And most importantly, I am not convinced that as they carry on, they are substantially improving the lot of black Americans. I mean, what really is being achieved? Initially, there were some concrete demands made by protesters, and they were sound. You know, charge the policeman and also arrest his perceived accomplices. And both of those things were done in short order. So the aims of these protests did nothing but expand, and I'm afraid they tended to expand into an area that is ultimately unfulfillable, that is the end to structural racism, which is so abstract that it means that these protests are in danger of demanding nothing concrete. In other words, having gone from solid demands, now we've gone into a kind of we want utopia, and that doesn't really help anybody.
Well, there are some concrete demands that are being advanced, for example, by the 1619 Project, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning founder of that project, Nicole Hannah-Jones, and the specifics demand is reparations.
Right, and I think that would be a catastrophe, personally. I mean, first off, who's black? Do we do some kind of blood test? If you're only half black, do you get only half as much money? What about all the other minorities who might have claims to historical injustice, like Native Americans? And exactly how fair is it to ask sometimes quite poor white Americans to pay perhaps quite wealthy black people? I mean, there is no end to the complexity and the capacity to generate enormous and I think even dangerous resentment. So I've never supported reparations, and I think that there's a good argument to be made from the perspective of black Americans that you can't buy your way out of this, right? You know, it's the idea is that you pay them off to shut up, and no amount of money is going to make slavery not have happened.
Right.
Or is no amount of money is going to erase the amount of racial injustice that has already occurred. And all we've got control over is the future. So we'll try to be better. But the money, first off, you know, money evaporates. It goes away. It's unlikely, it's absolutely impossible that any program of reparations would be on a sufficient financial scale to permanently readjust the wealth of black Americans.
And
so what would more likely be that it would be like that check you got from Trump, the $1,200, which I dare say most people have already frittered away.
Well, Will, when we come back, I just want to continue our conversation briefly on that and ask the question that is implicit in Jason Riley's piece in The Wall Street Journal about police racism, which he argues is not at epidemic proportions. Upwards of 95% of black homicides in the U.S. don't involve law enforcement. Can you buy your way out of that? More with Lionel Shriver, contributor to The Spectator and author of the recently released The Motion of the Body Through Space, right after this.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with bestselling author Lionel Shriver. She's a contributor to The Spectator and author of the recently released novel, The Motion of the Body Through Space. We were talking a little bit about reparations, one of the concrete demands that's been made and specific proposals that have been advocated. And I mentioned Jason Riley's piece before the break in The Wall Street Journal, Jason Riley talking about police racism and arguing based on the numbers. And he goes into some depth with the help of criminologists' work product on why he believes that police racism is not epidemic. He notes that police shootings have fallen precipitously since the 1970s. Upward of 95% of black homicides in the U.S. don't involve law enforcement. Empirical studies have found no racial bias in the police use of deadly force, including by African-American Harvard economist Roland Fryer, we talked about yesterday, and that racial disparities that do exist do not stem from racial differences in criminal behavior. And so the issue of reparations, you can't buy your way to financial independence or reparation your way to financial independence, probably for many of the 42 million black Americans who I guess would be in line for reparations, at least under some proposals. Do you think you can buy your way out of social pathologies like the fact you have, as Jason Riley points out, 95% of black homicides that do not involve law enforcement?
Well, I think one of the things that has been stark about this Black Lives Matter iteration of 2020 has been that the facts don't matter.
Right.
So there really is no statistical basis for this level of indignation. There was one incident which was horrific, and we are seeking judicial redress for that. But there was a team at Harvard University in 2016 that produced the results of a study of the 10 largest cities in the United States and the record on police homicide, and they found no record, a disparate number of black Americans shot by police. And it was conducted by a black Harvard professor.
Yeah, Roland Fryer.
And he was astonished.
Yeah.
And I thought one of the things that was in, because I remember reading about the results of that study, because I was in the States at the time, I got a physical New York Times, and it was published literally below the fold. So it was published quietly, and nobody wanted to talk about it because it was not what liberal America wanted to discover. But the trouble is that from the start, you know, you can come up with all the statistics you like, and nobody listens. It doesn't make any difference. There is an anecdotal impression that the United States is awash with white cops murdering unarmed black civilians. The racial situation here is getting worse and worse and worse, whereas in truth it's getting better and better and better. But the facts make no impact. And I think that's one of the most disturbing things about our time, that people respond to emotive stimuli. In other words, you can publish all the statistics you like, but if there's one video that goes viral that makes people feel an enthralling sense of indignation and injustice, that you can't, you know, your statistics are meaningless.
Well, I think that's right. And it's not limited to police. Going back to what Professor Cochran said about being afraid to offend somebody in the classroom on campus. I mean, you're highly educated. You've been on, you were educated at the Ivy League. I believe you got your MFA at Columbia, right?
That's correct.
So you know what
it's kind of a sad degree, actually.
well, it probably meant more, now that it was that long ago, but probably meant more when you got it than it does today.
No, it didn't.
Okay.
It didn't.
All right. But, I mean, what about that culture of fear that intellectuals and professionals across every sector are feeling that they could get on the wrong side of the mob?
Well, I can speak for myself and for the profession of writing fiction that I feel under the gun a lot of the time. I live with some fear that at any time I will say the wrong thing and be canceled. And if I feel that, and I'm not a very cautious person, that means that my colleagues are quaking in terror. There's a whole raft of things that you're not supposed to write about. White writers are not sure whether they have permission anymore to write about other ethnicities. And we generally feel discouraged from going at sensitive topics because, of course, we might get in trouble. And it's not in the interest of good fiction, you know. You're not going to want to read these timorous novels.
Before we let you go, I want to give you a chance to profile your latest novel, The Motion of the Body Through Space, which focuses on certain cults of the day, like the cults around fitness, the fitness craze.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that needs to be amped up a little bit after the lockdowns. But anyway, give us a flavor for your latest work.
Well, I'm interested in the craze for fitness, which especially has ramped up, I would say, in the last 20 years. While I've always been pretty active myself, this is on a completely different order, and it especially gets out of control in the endurance sport industry, which, you know, becomes more and more extreme by the day. So I just took a couple in their early 60s, and she's been very privately vigorous her whole life, but her knees are shot and has had to curtail her activities, and of course her husband chooses that exact moment to decide he wants to run a marathon. And a little later in the book, that ramps up to wanting to run a full triathlon. And those things are insane. I don't know whether you've seen any of this Ironman stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable.
I see it from the comfort of a golf course, yes.
And, you know, it's this. He becomes obsessed, as one does with this stuff, and doesn't give the marriage any mind, and nor any of his other obligations, including to his elderly father, becomes an unbearable narcissist. And that's one of the things I'm looking at, is that especially the endurance sports industry sells this absorption as being somehow noble and high-minded and spiritually advanced, and what it really is a form of self-involvement, or, you know, to be unjudgmental about it. It's a form of entertainment of a perverse variety. But most importantly, this absorption of her husband starts ruining their marriage. And I discovered after the fact, a friend of mine said she knew any number of women who had been married to men who got involved in triathlons, and they are all divorced.
Interesting. That's interesting. That's an interesting cohort, the Venn diagram of triathletes and divorce.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to picking up the book. I'm sure it's available on Amazon and Borders and all those places where you buy books.
It's meant to be a lot of fun.
Very good.
Does have a little backstory that people who are hostile to identity politics are going to enjoy.
Oh, even better. She is Lionel Shriver, contributor to The Spectator, author of the recently released novel, The Motion of the Body Through Space. Pick it up. Lionel Shriver, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I enjoy talking to you.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Well, there's no more saying that somebody is as fat as a pig. Not that you should ever say such a thing, because that's mean-spirited, but it just would be, in addition to being mean-spirited now, it's actually an insult and unfair to pigs. This from a new study under the Agriculture and Horticultural Development Board in the UK, noting the last two decades were worst for obesity trends among human beings. But pigs are going in a positive direction. We could learn something from our porcine friends, apparently. The pig fat content among pigs, has decreased from 30% to 16%. Who wants the job of getting the BMI readings on pigs? Anyway, the conclusion of the researchers, the pigs of this decade are much leaner than before, and draws a comparison between fat in pigs and fat in human beings. Fat levels in human beings right now, worst they've ever been, and they continue to increase more every year. A recent government health survey for England support the contention of the researchers in this pig study about high obesity rates. Susan Jebb teaches diet and population health at Oxford University. Recent research investigated the body fat of people living in the UK. Her study sample was more than 400,000 people, which gives her a pretty big picture of the larger population, and I do mean larger. Ms. Jebb's results, the average middle-aged man has a BMI of nearly 27.5. His fat levels range between 21 and 25%. In women, the fat levels between 33 and 38%. This new comparison suggests that if pigs have 16% fat in their body, they're leaner and meaner than humans. Yeah. Frederick Carpe teaches metabolic medicine at Oxford. He adds that the obesity trend analysis shows that pigs and humans are going in the opposite directions. Maybe it'll be humans that's what's for dinner. And it also appears that pigs are somehow less fat than humans now. Agrees this Oxford University professor agrees. So, yeah, the joke of calling someone fat as a pig, not that it's very funny. Fat as a human. And, you know, this is in the UK, but we know the obesity trends in the United States are similar. We can surmise it such. Huh. The study also suggests the increase in human fat levels, the obvious reasons. Poor diet, lack of exercise. Well, I don't think the lockdowns over the last 3 months in the UK or the US have helped much, have they? But maybe the comparison, the unfavorable comparison to pigs, to swine, will motivate some to hit the gyms when they reopen. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Please do so again tomorrow.
Fake news. He's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.